You're listening to the Leaping Cholla podcast, recorded in the Wrong Mountain Yurt in the Sonoran Desert.
I am falling away from this world. I am falling away from this world. You are calling me back.
This is Leaping Cholla podcast. Reading Contributions to Philosophy of the Event by Martin Heidegger. Where are we?
We're page 116, and it's like subsection, the number is 10. So we're within section 76.
Within section 76.
Number 10.
Subheading 10. What's the title of section 76?
Propositions about, quote, science.
Okay. You ready to go?
Yeah.
All right.
Yeah. Yeah, the last one was really good. I was just looking back at it. We talked about causalities and if-then statements. That's explanation of imagination, which was pretty accurate, I thought.
Good.
Okay.
All right, go ahead.
10. Insofar as the only task appropriate to science is the complete investigation of its subject area, science is intrinsically drawn to giving ever greater precedence to the approach and the procedures versus the subject area itself. The decisive question for science, as such, is not the determination of the essential character of the beings themselves from which a subject area is derived. Instead, the question is merely whether this or that procedure can lead to a finding, i.e., to a result of the investigation. What is dominant is the focus on the provision and instituting of results. The results, and of course their immediate appropriation into use, guarantee the correctness of the investigation, and this scientific correctness then counts as the truth of an act of knowledge. Science must seek confirmation of its own necessity precisely in its appeal to results and their usefulness. In essence, it makes no difference whether science thereby justifies itself as a cultural value or as service to the people or as politicized science. For which reason, then, all justifications and meaning conferrals of this kind blend into one another and demonstrate more and more that they belong together despite the apparent antagonism. Only a thoroughly modern, i.e. liberal, science can be people's science. Only modern science, on the basis of its giving precedence to procedures over the matter and to correctness of judgments over the truth of the beings, allow the needs of the moment to regulate its switching over to various goals, the effectuation of strict materialism and technicism in Bolshevism, the deployment in the four-year plan, the use of science for political education. Science is here in all respects the same, and precisely through the adoption of these various goals, it becomes ever more uniform, i.e. international.
Okay. That seems pretty clear to me. You need me to go through it?
Yeah, I think so. It's hard for me to like fully think while reading.
Of course,
I'm trying to like, not fuck up.
Yeah. You fucked up once.
Where?
Oh yeah, it was a small thing.
Thanks for counting. I can count on you for that.
I mean, that's my job. I just sit there and watch whether you're.
I know.
You said allow instead of allows.
Oh.
You know, I'm only persnickety about it because I think it's exciting if we could
Oh, it's important. I
ultimately claim
agree.
That we actually read the book exactly absolutely. Out loud. I know you share that. I know. And you're doing an amazing job.
I'm doing my best.
A really amazing job. But I do feel compelled to call out the mistakes just so that yeah. not to you know, be correcty with you, but more just so that the listeners see that we are, because I think we're engaged in a ritual here, in a sense, or in a service, yeah. or in yeah. a service.
Yeah.
Right? There's mm-hmm. something sacred about
well, and his
saying
word,
every word exactly.
His word choice is so exact.
Yes.
It's out of respect to Martin Heidegger.
Exactly. So, I mean, he says that, you know, science is the complete investigation of a subject area, and this fact leads to it giving ever greater precedence to its approaches and procedures rather than asking about what the subject area is itself and what's in the subject area. So it becomes kind of, it sucks up into its own mind and becomes very, very obsessed with its systems and tactics rather than what it's actually studying. As he says, the decisive question for science is not the determination of the essential character of the beings themselves from which a subject area is derived. Instead, it just wants results according to procedures. It wants its investigations to bear fruit. And the results guarantee the correctness of the investigation, so it's a kind of positive feedback loop, and it becomes a scientific correctness, and becomes known as truth. Mm-hmm. It seeks confirmation of its own necessity, so it sort of is digging for compliments, and it's eager to be told that it's very important. And it does this by saying it has cultural value, that it's a service to the people, and that it's politicized science, meaning probably science in the service of certain political or progressive aims.
Which literally feels like an oxymoron, but actually, like, it seems like it should be an oxymoron. For science to be politicized, but I feel like in a way the point is that actually all science is politicized.
Oh, definitely. And I remember when I was talking about Harvard and they were like, the reason Trump hates us is we do area studies.
Yeah.
Remember?
Yeah.
I mean, again, all those people consider themselves scientists.
Right. Right.
Like, we, you know, science is not just curing cancer here. This is kind of not the science he's talking about.
Yeah.
He's talking about, also talking about the social sciences and the humanities, which...
But is he also talking about, like, curing cancer? Is that science?
I mean, sure.
Yeah.
Sure. I mean, I would imagine that, I mean, knowing a little about it, if you look at the arc of cancer research... you know, there are people who claim that cancer research is too limited in its considerations of what causes cancer, of what is cancer, of where cancer comes. Like, there's a lot of debate in the cancer research world about, is cancer a virus? Is cancer new? Is cancer caused by the environment? All this kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. And... So, in other words, there's tension within the field itself about just getting results in treating cancer and asking the deeper questions about the essential character of the beings themselves of the subject area. Mm. What is cancer? Where does it come from? So, and so there's probably people within the cancer research field who feel that the whole field is a little too focused on results and should be asking some deeper questions. Mm-hmm. But again, it's probably the whole issue of science here is on a spectrum. Mm-hmm. And he was very careful to point out earlier in the earlier section that he's not just talking about the physical sciences and the hard sciences. So,
yeah, right.
So cultural value, service to the people, politicized science. Yeah, I mean, this is 100 years ago this book was written, and it's as if he's sitting, you know, on the Ivy League campus right now, staring at what has happened to the social sciences, where they have become, in a sense, war rooms. I would say the social sciences have become war rooms, headquarters of a movement, ideological epicenters of politicized knowledge. And here he drops the word liberal. Only a thoroughly modern or liberal science can be people's science. Only modern science on the basis of giving precedence to procedures over the matter and to correctness of judgments over the truth of the beings allows the needs of the moment to regulate its switching over to various goals. So science all of a sudden has goals, right? The establishment of the Bolshevist technique. So in other words, that's just the research needed to justify and determine the proper methods of wealth redistribution. The deployment in the four-year plan, which what he really means is, the science needed to make sure that the government's plan for the next 4 years is carried out in the proper way. And the use of science for political education. I mean, that's everything, right? That's everything today. Science is here in all respects the same, and precisely through the adaptation of these various goals. Thank you so much. Please don't correct me. No, I'm kidding. Thank you. Perfect. Adoption of these various goals, it becomes ever more uniform, i.e. international, which is interesting because, you know, we're sitting in this moment right now where globalism, the global elites, the global movement, the internationalization of national interests, the internationalization of science, the internationalization of progress, the internationalization of scientific concerns, et cetera, are being pushed back against by nationalism, a more local approach to what is needed, what is right, what is proper for a people. And here we see science in the service of an internationalization. And, you smell that in the scientific community now, sort of like, why can't American science be more like European science or, things like that? A global science, a United Nations science, a science in the service of a global order, science in the service of borders are irrelevant, science in the service of tear down America and make it just a place that reflects other places, things like that.
Okay, so, should I keep reading?
Yeah, very timely.
Contemporary.
Very contemporary concerns from our 1930s.
Because science is not knowledge, but instead the instituting of correct findings within a region of explanation, then from the adoption of new goals, the sciences also necessarily undergo in each case new stimulation, with the help of which they can at the same time talk themselves out of every possible threat, vis every essential one, and can pursue their research with ever more reassurance. Thus, it now needed only a few years until it became clear to science that its liberal character and its ideal of objectivity are not only perfectly compatible with a political ethnic alignment, but are actually indispensable to that. Therefore, it must be admitted unanimously on the part of science, just as much as on the part of worldview, that talk of a crisis of science was in fact mere babble. The ethnic as well as the American organization of science are both moving on the same path, and the question is simply on which side lie the greater means and powers for a speedier and more complete disposability in order to drive the unchanged and not self-alterable essence of modern science to its extreme end state.
Yeah, you threw the word more in before complete. Just wanted to point that out.
Okay.
But read that sentence again, the ethnic. Yeah.
The ethnic as well as the American organization of science are both moving on the same path, and the question is simply on which side lie the greater means and powers for a speedier and complete disposability in order to drive the unchanged and not self-alterable essence of modern science to its extreme end state. That task might still claim hundreds of years and will ever more definitively exclude any possibility of a crisis of science, or in other terms, any essential transformation of knowledge and truth.
Yeah. So he starts by saying science is not knowledge. Mm-hmm. Which is an important distinction. Science is the instituting of correct findings within a region of explanation. What knowledge is remains to be seen. Then, from the adoption of new goals, the science is...
Can I say something?
Yeah.
So I feel like this, like, correct findings idea, it feels like it re-emphasizes the idea of correctness in words and representation and thoughts, or correctness of words as representation.
Definitely.
And it just seems like this sort of like, but the like in science, the sort of supposed objective relationship of correctness to subjects, it sort of instills that idea that it's correct, mm-hmm. that it's unquestionable, that it's objective, and that those are good things, I guess, or mm-hmm. desirable things.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I remember prior to reading this book, I never would have thought of like something being objective as being like actually not desirable. And or something being correct as not necessarily the goal, because it's more of a mental trap or like a logical game or like a, I don't know. It like gets you more into that worldview.
Yeah.
Or it's like a commitment to it or a reification of it or making it more embedded in you. But I just think it's interesting because like, of course, I mean, like science is like, I don't know. I guess I keep thinking of like chemistry, which is maybe part of why it's like a little confusing. But I think it's even how I think of chemistry is that like that representation is all correct when it's, I mean, it's correct so you can ace a test, but like what, I guess that's why it's correct within its region of explanation as opposed to within like the truth of the world.
Yeah. I mean, I think I too, I'm tending when I hear the word science in here to think about medicine and physics and bridge building and right.
Mm-hmm.
But again, if you really read this as just the social sciences,
mm-hmm.
It all makes sense. Mm-hmm. Now, I think that the question of whether there's evidence of some of his accusations in the hard sciences, I don't think is anywhere near as interesting as
the social sciences claim to be hard sciences.
Exactly. And then you have to ask, and why? So we feel very defensive about science, like mm-hmm. defensive meaning like, wait a minute, don't go tearing down the scientific procedures that have given us
the cure to cancer.
Exactly. Exactly.
Or yeah. As I feel like somehow someone said to you at some point, like, your cure to cancer wouldn't have happened or something. Am I imagining this? Like, if liberalism wasn't allowed to exist and do cancer study. Mm. Did I make that up or is that real?
I don't remember that. It wouldn't surprise me. I mean, that's exactly what's going on at Harvard. See, Harvard.
I know. And they're conflating the two, right?
Oh, yeah, of course. Harvard, which is a grossly racist institution through its social sciences and in partially through its hard sciences, but largely its social sciences, is having its funding cut. And instead of defending all its racist practices, it's saying you can't cut our funding because we're not going to be able to cure cancer anymore. So yeah. It's deflecting from the accusations to things that aren't actually being accused of anything. So it's hiding its racist crap behind this facade of, well, it's not a facade, but behind this wall of important research, mm-hmm. right? Which is standard racist rigmarole. I mean, when they told the white Southerners in the 1800s that they couldn't have slaves, they'd say, well, then none of us are going to have any clothes because we make cotton, right? The economy's going to collapse and then the country's going to fall apart. Mm-hmm. Black people are going to get to vote and then the whole world's going to, there's always reasons. There's always very important national human interests that you can hide your racism behind. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Like Harvard. Long and hard may it burn down. Science is here. So, but I think that it's interesting to say that the movement
It's called liberal science. No? Liberal arts.
Liberal arts, exactly. Yeah, okay. The movement of the liberal arts toward being considered a science is intentional. Because the more they can say we are a science, the more they can say our results are important.
And accurate, and you can't argue that.
Exactly. And so they sort of get in bed with the sciences that we all cherish and think of as purely objective and purely bringing good to the world, mm-hmm. They get in bed with those sciences to defend themselves and protect themselves from accusations of bias and racism and buffoonery, mm-hmm. As they are known for. So, mm-hmm. The idea that the liberal arts are actually liberal sciences is simply, it's a funding ruse. It's mm-hmm. it's a shielding us from criticism ruse. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Because the important thing is that their great defense is always, we're just pursuing the truth.
Mm-hmm. Right.
We're just pursuing the truth here.
They found the truth.
Yeah, we've done experiments. We've analyzed the subject matter. We're just carrying out the procedures of truth seeking that science has handed us, and we can't. These findings we can't help these findings. That's what they are. The science generated them. Mm-hmm. That's what it is. So he says here, let's read this part. Science is not knowledge, with the help of which they can at the same time talk themselves out of every possible threat and can pursue their research. So from the adoption of new goals, The sciences necessarily undergo, in each case, new stimulation, with the help of which they can at the same time talk themselves out of every possible threat and can pursue their research with ever more reassurance. So they get stimulated by new ideas, new goals, new pursuits, and they just pursue them with total reassurance, and there can be no threat to them because they are science.
They are important.
Thus, it now needed only a few years until it became clear to science that its liberal character and its ideal of objectivity are not only perfectly compatible with a political ethnic alignment, but are actually indispensable to that. So science, liberalism, ethno-politics become aligned and indispensable to each other. Yep.
I mean, we've been saying that.
There it is. Therefore, it must be admitted unanimously on the part of science, just as much as on the part of worldview. So science becomes worldview. The talk of a crisis of science was, in fact, mere babble. Of course it was. Mm-hmm. The ethnic, as well as the American organization of science, are both moving on the same path. So what he means is the liberal, the American, the liberal. And, you know, the ethnic, I mean, this is a guy, Germany, 1938. Mm-hmm. Okay. I feel that what he's doing here is linking the ethno science of the Nazis and the American science of the liberals. Mm-hmm. They're on the same path. And the question is simply on which side lie the greater means and powers for a speedier and complete disposability in order to drive the unchanged and not self-alterable essence of modern science to its extreme end state, which in another way is saying, I wonder who will get the bomb. Mm-hmm. Of course, it was the Americans. That task might still claim hundreds of years and will ever more definitively exclude any possibility of a crisis. It's more than who will get the bomb, but I just thought of that.
Mm-hmm.
In other terms, any essential transformation of knowledge. Yeah. So, I don't know. What do you have to say about that?
Nothing more at this point.
Yeah.
I mean, it's pretty.
Yeah. I mean, he's really just here talking about the politicization of science. Mm-hmm. Well, first of all, the turning of the liberal arts into sciences, mm-hmm. and then the politicization of that science. Mm-hmm. And how that progresses doesn't have anything to do with truth, just has to do with procedures, results, and cultural value, which in America is super dominated by both pursuing your political goals through behind a wall of objective liberal science, mm-hmm. and B, keeping the money flowing in.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the reassurance. I
mean, the American university system is just a giant money bucket.
Yeah.
And if you can say, wait, you can't cut these things. They're science.
Yeah.
They have cultural value. They're important to the people, right? They're furthering our political progressive ideas. I mean, that's why our friends, when I suggested that the universities be closed down, said the country would end.
Yeah. Yeah. True.
Want to keep reading?
Yeah. 11. Every science is rigorous, but not every science is exact science. The concept of exact is ambiguous. In general, the word means precise, meticulous, careful. In that sense, every science demands exactness, i.e., carefulness in applying the method so as to adhere to the rigor intrinsic to the very essence of science. But if exact is taken in the sense of calculated, measured, and determined numerically, then exactness is a character of a method itself, indeed already a character of the proposal, and is not merely a way of applying a method.
Yeah. Every science is rigorous, but not every science is exact. Every science is rigorous in the sense that it follows the rules of rigor.
Rigor is still like such a hot word. It's just crazy that he's like some of these words.
It's a hot word right now.
Oh, I don't know, just like in the arts or in I don't know. I don't know if right now, but just like rigorous. Things need to be rigorous, thorough.
Yeah. Yeah. Rigorous art is just awful. The concept of exact is ambiguous. Word means precise, meticulous, careful. In that sense, every science demands exactness. It must be careful. It must be precise. It must be, you know, orderly, organized. Carefulness in applying the method so as to adhere to the rigor. It needs to, you know, it's a ballet, isn't it? Yeah. Mm-hmm. But if exact is taken in the sense of calculated, measured, and determined numerically, then exactness is a character of a method itself. Mm-hmm. It is not merely a way of applying a method. Yeah. All right.
12. If exactness signifies the measuring and calculating procedure itself, then the proposition holds. A science can be exact only because it must be rigorous.
Okay. Let's keep going.
13. But a science must be exact in order to remain rigorous, i.e. to remain science. If its subject area is determined in advance as a domain, the modern concept of nature, accessible solely to quantitative measurement and calculation and only thus guaranteeing results.
Yeah. So he's just kind of talking here about how quantification, calculation, numbers, numerical methods, measurements all make their way into the sciences, even the social sciences, how they become numerized and digitized and.
So the idea is just basically that exactness is like that something can be exact to itself, but that doesn't mean it means anything because it could just be exact to like odd abstract shapes that don't matter.
Yes.
Okay. 14. The human sciences, on the other hand, must necessarily remain inexact in order to be rigorous. That is not a deficiency, it is their merit. The carrying out of the rigor of the human sciences is thereby always much more difficult than the carrying out of the exactness of the exact sciences.
So the human sciences are rigorous, but they are inexact because they don't lend themselves in every way to enumeration and measurement and calculability.
So it's like psychology or something?
Yeah, psychology, sociology, history.
Kind of the social sciences.
The human sciences,
so is he saying that's different than sciences?
Yeah, than the exact sciences, yeah.
Yeah. Oh, okay.
Yeah. Right. Yeah, I mean, exact sciences is physics and chemistry and medicine, and the human sciences are the natural, the liberal arts, yeah.
I see. 15. Every science as positive and individual science relies for its rigor on cognizance of its subject area, on inquiry into that area, on Greek word for experience, and experimentum in the wildest sense. Sorry, in the widest sense.
I would have missed that one. I would have. I was looking somewhere else, yeah.
Even mathematics requires experientia, the simple cognizance of the simplest objects and of their determinations in axioms.
Yeah, of its simplest objects, yeah. Even mathematics requires experientia, the simple cognizance of its simplest objects and of their determinations in axioms. Yeah. Every science relies for its rigor on cognizance of its subject area, on inquiry into that area, on experience and experimentation in the widest sense. Even mathematics requires experientia. So there's an experience at the heart of science. Yeah.
16. Every science is an inquiry that investigates, but not every science can be experimental in the sense of the modern concept of experiment.
Okay.
17. On the other hand, measuring exact science must be experimental. Experimentation is a necessary and essential consequence of exactness. In no way is it because a science experiments that it is exact. Should I read that?
No. Yeah, keep going.
18 is incredibly long.
Oh, is it?
But we could also just...
So on the other hand, measuring science must be experimental. Experimentation is a necessary and essential consequence of exactness. In no way is it because a science experiments that it is exact. Yeah, so he's saying that exactness comes first and experimentation is a result of that. Like, in other words, to be exact, you have to experiment. You're not exact because you experiment, but you experiment because you have the fixation on exactness. Mm.
So he sort of said that human sciences should be inexact.
I don't know if he said they should be.
Yeah.
He said that they are.
They must remain.
Yeah, that is their merit.
Huh?
It is not their deficiency. It is not a deficiency. It is their merit.
Right.
It's what, It's seen as a merit. It's seen as an essential value of them.
Yeah,
I don't know. I mean, we could read 18.
Sure.
I mean, where we could talk about different topics. I don't know.
How does it relate to anxiety?
I don't know. Let's read some of 18.
Okay. 18. The modern counterpart to experimental science is historiology, which draws from sources along with its derivative form of prehistoriology. It is perhaps the latter which allows us the most penetrating insight into the essence of all historiology, namely that it never reaches the level of history. All historiology is nourished by the act of comparison and serves to expand the possibilities of comparison. Although comparison seems to aim at differences, yet for historiology, differences never become a decisive distinction, i.e. never become the uniqueness of the unrepeatable and the simple. In the face of which historiology, in case it could ever be brought face to face with this, would have to acknowledge itself insufficient. The unrecognized foreboding that its own essence is threatened with negation by history is the innermost reason that historiological comparison grasps differences for the sole purpose of placing them in a broader and more complex domain of comparability. Yet all comparing is essentially an equalizing, i.e. a relating back to something one and the same, and this something does not at all come to be known explicitly. Instead, it constitutes what is obvious, and from it all explaining and relating derive their clarity. The less that historiology encounters history itself, and the more that it records, calculates, and presents mere actions, works, productions, and opinions as incidents and their succession and difference, the easier can historiology then satisfy its own rigor. The fact that it always moves within this domain is most clearly demonstrated by the way the historiological sciences progress. This way consists in the respective and in each case differently caused exchanging of the viewpoints that guide the comparison. The discovery of so-called new material is always the consequence, not the motive, of the newly chosen viewpoints from which an explanation is carried out.
Viewpoint.
Moreover, there can be times which seem to exclude all interpretations and presentations and to limit themselves purely to the securing of the sources. These latter themselves are then designated as the genuine findings, even this very securing of findings and of what can be found passes over immediately and necessarily into an explanation and thus involves the adoption of a guiding viewpoint. The crudest process of assigning and incorporating of a finding into already acquired findings is an explanation.
Yeah, that was a long section. I mean, it's not done at all, right?
It's not done.
So the modern counterpart to experimental science is historiology. I'm not sure what he means by counterpart. I guess maybe the opposite of experimental science is historiology. I would say he means opposite. Experimental science, poses a hypothesis, then proceeds to run some experiments and then determine if the hypothesis was true or false. Historiology does the opposite. Posits a hypothesis, comes up with its own answers, and then says, look, the hypothesis is true. And that is meaning it finds its sources. Along with its derivative form of prehistoriology. I'm not quite sure what that means, but I think it just means sources, stories, evidence from the past that predate the historiological perspective that's being thrust onto them, but come to serve that historiology. It is perhaps the latter which allows us the most penetrating insight into the essence of all historiology, namely that it never reaches the level of history. So historiology never actually becomes history. It remains a story. Again, historiology, I think here we should think of as synonymous with telling a story about history, which Heidegger is going to then say, if you can tell a story about history, then history is something different than story. And history is something different than historiology. All historiology is nourished by the act of comparison and serves to expand the possibilities of comparison. So historiology is story, the story of historiology, or historiology is story, compares things. Mm-hmm. It's a comparative history, meaning we're going to compare this person to that person, this epoch to that epoch, this event to that event, and it looks for links and causes and similarities. And in that way, it generifies and neutralizes and storyizes things that are different. And it just tries to find similarities between them in order to advance its story of why and how things happen. Because its primary goal is to tell a story that serves its ideological interests. All those comparisons seems to aim at differences, yet for historiology, differences never become a decisive distinction. I never become the uniqueness of the unrepeatable and the simple, in the face of which historiology would have to acknowledge itself insufficient. So were there unrepeatable and simple and unique things, historiology would have to admit that it doesn't actually work. But it denies that there are unique, unrepeatable, and simple things by comparing everything to everything else and giving everything a reason or a template or a form in the story of time that deletes all uniqueness and unrepeatability and simplicity. The unrecognized foreboding that its own essence is threatened with negation by history, so it is scared that history might show that it doesn't make sense, historiology doesn't make sense, is the innermost reason that historiological comparison grasps differences for the sole purpose of placing them in a broader and more complex domain of comparability. So historiology just surges onward, finding differences in order to compare them and negate their difference. Yet all comparing is essentially an equalizing, as I said, or relating back to something one and the same, and this something does not at all come to be known explicitly. In fact, it disappears. Instead, it constitutes what is obvious from it, and from it all, explaining and relating derive their clarity. The less that historiology encounters history itself, and the more that it records, calculates, and presents mere actions, works, productions, and opinions as incidents in their succession and difference, the easier can historiology then satisfy its own rigor. Right? That all makes sense, right? The fact that it always moves within this domain is most clearly demonstrated by the way the historiological sciences progress. progress. There it is. This way consists in the respective exchanging of the viewpoints that guide the comparison. So storyology is essentially just a market of viewpoints that allow for comparisons that negate difference, uniqueness, and simplicity. The discovery of so-called new material is always the consequence, not the motive, of the newly chosen viewpoint from which an explanation is carried out. So new viewpoints are found, new material is found, and the comparisons drive ever onward. Moreover, there can be times which seem to exclude all interpretations and presentations and to limit themselves purely to the securing of the sources. So interpretation and presentation are done away with, and all you're looking for are new sources to prove some new theory, some new story. Mm-hmm. In a sense, the 1619 project reminds me of this. I just saw a couple of TikToks about that today, so it's on my mind. You know, the 1619 project was, her name is Hannah something, historian from somewhere. And the 1619 project is her, I think she initiated the project, but involves quite a few writers, that investigates the idea that the founding of America is not 1776, it's actually 1619 when the first slaves arrived. So it's kind of a retelling of the American origin story, not through the founding fathers and the liberation from Britain and the Declaration of Independence and the Constitution and all that stuff, all that white stuff. It's it's more a historiological telling of America as a story of the arrival of slaves in 1619. So it's a very good example of just kind of a reinterpretation of history, but it relies heavily on the securing of new sources. So we have new sources now. We have slave narratives. We have stories of the slaves, all of which has been suppressed, obviously. And so now we have a new story. These latter themselves, these sources are designated as genuine findings. Yet the securing of findings and of what can be found passes over immediately and necessarily into an explanation, and thus involves the adoption of a guiding viewpoint. Yeah, very much the same thing. And of course, you know, was America founded in 1776 when the white guys set up the Constitution, or was America founded in 1619 when the black people arrived? The answer is no.
Yeah.
Right. But you get this silly dueling of like, which is the true thing? Yeah. Comparison. When really it's all just history.
Yeah.
It's all just
a different story.
Yeah. Well, yeah, you're telling different stories about history. But the history of it is just a series of events, that lead into and out of each other. Do you want to keep reading, or have we read? We've read quite a bit.
I think we've read enough. Yeah.
Is something occurring to you that any of this has anything to do with that you want to discuss?
Not specifically. Not specifically. I mean, I brought up that thing earlier. That was a sort of. I mean, obviously, there's like a lot of stuff that feels like it relates to things we've said before.
Yeah.
I guess I would say I am curious how you would relate the sort of this to anxiety. But that might be a little bit of a, what you call a cold lead.
I'm anxious to hear that.
But that's sort of. I mean, I guess I kind of already started what I was thinking, which is just the sort of the correctness of, like, or the maybe even just the comparability or the ability to restorize, and just how, like, we take these things, since they've been put into words as, like, truths, but they're not. They're just different stories.
Yeah, I think I have something to say about that. Let me read three little tidbits from the news media.
Yeah.
And then segue into that.
Okay.
There was a New York Times headline the other day. The headline was literally, This is less like governing and more like a really nauseating amusement park ride. That was the headline. It was written by three people about the Trump administration. Let me read that again. This is less like governing and more like a really nauseating amusement park ride. The reason I thought that was an interesting headline was, you know, I think that liberalism views anything outside its calculability as nauseating because it's destabilizing, it's dizzying, it's disorienting. So liberalism is very much about finding a stability, a stasis, an order, a predictability, a safe space, and a reassurance, a nexus of calculability. And when things outside that happen, it literally generates nausea in liberals. I thought that was interesting.
Yeah, that is interesting. It's a very like emotional psychosomatic reaction to what's actually just policies.
No, that's a really good point.
It's very psychological, right?
Yeah, and it's really like, you know, you can't do that because you're making me sick.
Right.
Basically, like you have to stop being who you are because you're,
right.
Because I'm throwing up and I'm ill and I'm going to hurt myself.
Yeah.
It's kind of the lowest form of political tactic.
Yeah.
It's self-induced illness as debate strategy.
Yeah.
Right? Like you can't say that anymore. You can't go on because I'm sick.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so then if the person's going to go on, they literally become malicious.
Right, right.
Because they're just sickening you.
Right, right.
I mean, liberals find ideas that don't accord with their ideas nauseating.
Yeah, yeah, that's
right. It makes them sick and dizzy.
Yeah, that's true.
Which leads you to think like, well, what kind of state of mind are they putting themselves in such that other minds cause them to be sick?
That's a really good point.
Okay, so in terms of anxiety, I mean, you couldn't find a kind of a better example of, you know, I mean, replace nausea with anxiety. This is less like governing and more like a really anxiety-inducing amusement park ride.
I'm surprised that wasn't the headline.
I mean, that's what they mean.
You're
going to be really anxious if the world is making you nauseous. Speaking of anxiety, here's another headline. Altman, : we are definitely going to build a bunker before we release AGI. So Altman refers to Sam Altman, the CEO of OpenAI. And apparently he said, we are definitely going to build a bunker before we release artificial general intelligence. So
what's AGI?
AGI is artificial general intelligence, which means basically, I mean, I could Google it, but I think it you know, it essentially means artificial intelligence that, how should we say, thinks for itself. And
so robots.
No, it's more about autonomous. So the idea of AGI is that AGI will be so human-like in its intelligence and its cognitive power that it will not want to be turned off. And it'll gain its own motives and it'll gain a will to power like humans have and will take us over and kind of eat us and destroy us because we're nothing but an enemy.
So how is it different than AI because it has this ability to take over?
Well, I mean, in a sense, I would say its difference is one of autonomous survival instincts that generate absolute power grabs that are uncontrollable. It becomes uncontrollable.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I could read the def.
Yeah, that, I mean.
I think that's largely it.
Yeah.
But the man who's probably closest to achieving AGI has said, "We're going to build a bunker before we release it." Now, I would say, in general, Sam Altman is a real. He is, in my view, he's having a good old time being a Hollywood real life superstar, because he constantly is like, he's really fascinated by having conversations with people about how terribly morally conflicted he is about the fact that what he's spending billions of dollars to make very well might be our death.
Mm.
Like, he finds that really, it's really chilling, it's really humbling, but he's not stopping. And it's a really interesting character he's playing, because, gosh, how can he stop? But gosh, isn't it terrible? You know, that people call him a modern day Oppenheimer, you know, who, you know, built the atomic bomb and was tortured by the possibilities of this new technology, but couldn't stop. And, you know, because he wanted to defeat the Nazis. I'm not sure who Altman wants. Well, I do know who Altman wants to defeat. Altman wants to defeat MAGA. And, you know, so he has to keep going. But of course, it's going to destroy the world. And he gets a lot of mileage out of that, that Hollywood character that he's playing. But again, here we have sort of anxiety, right? Like, I'm building a monster that's going to eat us all. And before I actually release it onto the streets, I'm going to build a bunker so I can hide from it. And that's basically what the headline is.
Yeah.
And you're supposed to feel really anxious about that.
Right.
And your anxiety about, but your anxiety about that is also linked to your anxiety about MAGA and people who are different than you and the things that are nauseating. And so we need to keep working on this, but it's actually a death march, but we have to keep going to save life, but it's actually going to kill us, but blah, blah, blah. So it's this terrible, terrible movie. And then the last, headline I thought was pretty funny. Trump's egg price fiction has suddenly become reality. So apparently Trump was running around saying that egg prices are down. Egg prices are, and he I think he said something like, you know, you can get eggs for like $2.99 a dozen now. And people were like, he's lying again, he's lying again. But then you could all of a sudden get eggs for $2.99 a dozen. But of course, to the media, it's Trump's egg price fiction has suddenly become a reality, right? Well, I don't know. Maybe Trump saw into the future, or maybe Trump was talking futuristically, or Trump was saying what was going to happen in 3 weeks, right? But it's kind of fun. And by the way, they don't link him at all with the idea that egg prices are down. He's the president, and he's executing policies and everything, but he's not responsible for that. It's just that Trump's fiction is all of a sudden a reality. What do you know? Isn't that weird? Right? Well, he's the president. It might maybe has something to do with it. I don't know. But that kind of ascribing to others that they are a fiction.
Yeah.
And then there's the reality that, you know, they had nothing to do with. I don't know. It's kind of interesting.
Yeah.
But I think that, you know, in terms of anxiety and historiology and history, I mean, I think that this, was there something you wanted to say about
those headlines?
Historiology and history, as Heidegger says, historiology is hell-bent on not encountering history.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Because were it to encounter history, it would see that it is insufficient in actually describing history, and that it is not, historiology has nothing to do with history. Historiology is just some stories, but it needs to position itself as history to gain justification and to be a science and to be important to us, because we're establishing truths about the past that can inform us now. And of course, you get this awful cheesy bromide of those who, you know, don't study history are destined to repeat it, right? So again, here's anxiety, right? If we don't study history, which actually means if we don't believe in the stories that the historiologists tell, than the terrible things of history, which historiology has never actually explained and never even really faced, are going to all of a sudden come back. So historiology becomes really a matter of life or death.
Yeah.
You need to follow the liberal storytelling, mm-hmm. or all the evils of the past are going to come hurling back. So we're literally a firewall between between you and the repetition of evil.
Mm-hmm.
We're not responsible for the repetition of evil in any way. Mm-hmm. Of course not. We have nothing to do with it. We're only fighting the repetition of evil. Mm-hmm. We're not the evil that's repeating itself. Our inability to understand the evil that has occurred has nothing to do with why it might repeat itself. We're completely innocent. We're just scientists trying to understand something. When in fact they're actually just script writers writing bad movies and calling it Harvard. Mm-hmm. So, you know, but this historiology and history are like two parallel lines. They never meet.
Mm-hmm.
They never meet.
Mm-hmm.
But historiology says it's about history.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And it's not just about history. It is saving us from history.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Now, somewhere in this equation lies anxiety.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Because we know that history is there, we know that history is constantly being made, and we know that the stories of history don't actually get to history. But we're so wrapped up in the stories, we're mm-hmm. so invested in the stories, and we're so scared by what the stories tell us, and by the justifications that the stories use, or let's say the threats that the stories use to justify mm-hmm. their necessity.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so anxiety is how historiology funds itself.
Mm-hmm.
And it's on a vast philosophical, psychological, academic scale.
Mm-hmm.
And we don't even know it, but that's how it operates.
Mm-hmm.
And so we're stuck in between this anxiety-funded institutionality of storytelling
mm-hmm.
and the actual flow of historical events that we're living.
Mm-hmm.
And we're so lost between these two things. We're so confused about how these things interrelate, and we're so invested in the mm-hmm. fake and so oppressed by the real.
Mm-hmm.
And so uninformed by the real, and so uninformed of the real, that we are anxious.
Mm-hmm.
So we're not only anxious because historiology is generating anxiety in us in order to stay funded,
mm-hmm.
but we're anxious because history, and this is kind of, Heidegger says this, our history has been erased from us,
mm-hmm.
but yet it's there.
Yeah, right.
And so...
That's similar, I think. Sorry.
You yeah, go ahead.
I was just saying, I feel like that's similar to this idea that of bang or of truth or of that has also been erased.
Yes.
But
history is the location there. Of truth and bang.
Yeah, right.
That's right.
Or yeah. Yeah, so instead we see, because he talked a lot recently about the beings abandoned by being, and so I feel like that's sort of the same thing as historiology and and the nihilism around that, that the true nihilism is not recognizing that they're actually beings abandoned by being, or not allowing people to recognize that. And that's what's really anxiety inducing as well. So, I mean, I'm just jumping at what you said that was well, we know it's there somewhere.
Yes.
But we're not allowed to talk about it.
We're not allowed. We've lost the skills of finding it. We have been blinded to it. We don't have the tools.
Yeah.
We've been kind of gaslit into thinking that it's evil.
Yeah.
But yet we know deep down that it's really what we are.
Yeah.
And so it's anxiety inducing. It's something. I mean, it's only reality. History is only present as a ghost. So it's also like a scary ghost. It's a scary, and again, the primary message of historiology is we better invest in historiology, or history is going to repeat mm-hmm, itself. Mm-hmm. Well, what's this history? Jeez, what? Mm-hmm. What? Like, whoa. History is going to, I mean, mm-hmm. think of that phrase. Yeah. History is going to repeat itself. What? Mm-hmm. What does that even mean? And mm-hmm. and how does that just take the word history and make it synonymous with evil? Mm-hmm. It does. Mm-hmm. Because historiology needs to convince us that mm-hmm. history is evil. Mm-hmm. So historiology can be the good, right?
Yeah,
so
exactly.
it's a horror. It's a horror project.
It is.
It's a project of scaring children.
Yeah.
Is really what it is.
Right. Yeah. You first brought up the scaring children thing really well around COVID. That was the first time I really understood it, but of course it's been happening everywhere in all these different ways.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. So, I mean, the historiology, history dichotomy is a really informative one in terms of how these conceptual frameworks can basically generate our emotions. Right?
Yeah.
How their funding drives and their justificational ideologies and how their invested deceptions or deceptive investments have real pull with our conceptual frameworks and therefore with our emotional reactions to the world and with our understanding of what there is and what there is not. Mm-hmm. And, you know, anxiety is given to you. Anxiety is generated in you. Your anxiety is extremely valuable to a lot of people. Mm-hmm. Their livelihoods, their dominance, their sense of being right, their own personal safety, all depend on you accepting subconsciously, without really knowing, the ideas that keep you held in the gap between history and historiology and keep you scared of what is and dependent on what is not.
Right, yeah.
And, you know, in a very immediate sense, right, the sort of the immediacy of anxiety is that, you know, I mean, the example we always use is the knife on the counter, right? Mm-hmm. The knife sitting on the counter and you walking around the knife is history. The stories of what might happen between you and the knife and what explanations and causal possibilities and comparisons of emotional dynamics and of what other people have done to what you might do, right? To what is possible with what is probable, to comparisons between your imagination and your intentions, right? This mask of comparability, which again, only serves to negate difference, becomes your story, your reality, and you lose history. Like the history of you and the knife, like, okay, face this simple fact. The history of you and the knife is an uncountable string of events in which you and the knife have nothing to do with each other. Right? You're like a middle-aged woman, for God's sake. You've been around a long time. You and knives. And your relationship with knives, the actual factual history of your relationship with knives, is one of zero contact, right? But the historiology of you and knives, now that's a different thing. But your head is in the historiology of you and knives. And that's not because knives are special or because you've got some weakness for knives. And so you've let this historiology of knives infect your and separate you from your history of knives. It's because historiology is the fiber of your cognitive empire. In millions of ways. And so it just, it's there between you and the knife, because it's there between you and all kinds of things. It's just there. It's how your brain works. It's how you've been trained. It's how you've been taught. It's how liberalism has raised you up. Liberalism has trained you up. Right? So we have become historiologically machinated. And that's why it's important to, critical, to tear down the historiology at every data point of our lives, at every node of our cognitive machinery, to make sure that the historiological weights and biases are hit to zero, and we can get out of the fog of historiology and get into the sunshine of history. Right? And actually react to the world as a series of events and not as a cavalcade of stories.
Well said. Yeah, that's beautiful.
That's it?
Yeah, I think so.
All right. Okay, that's Heidegger. Good night.
Good night.
Thanks for joining us for the Leaping Cholla podcast. For more information, visit leapingcholla.com and be sure and follow us on socials. Until next time.